Betches Media presents Betches Moms with hosts Aileen Drexler and Brittany Levine. Get ready to lock yourself in the bathroom or wherever else you hide from your kids, because you'll literally never be alone again.
Hello and welcome to the Betches Moms podcast. I'm Aileen.
And I'm Brittany. And today we're joined by Dr. Tiffany Jones. She's a fertility and fibroid specialist. Today she is here to talk all about starting her fertility journey, treatment options, and preparing for pregnancy. Welcome, Dr. Jones.
So glad to be here with everyone.
Thank you.
We're so excited to have you.
We're excited to talk about this. I feel like, you know, people don't always talk about this kind of stuff, even though so many women go through it. And we're really excited to hear your perspective. So can you tell us about yourself, your practice, everything you do when you go to work?
Yeah. So I am a board certified OBGYN. I did my training at USC for residency. And then I did a 3-year fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and infertility at Mayo Clinic. I currently practice at Conceive Fertility Center in Dallas, Texas. And my day-to-day is helping women either freeze their eggs for future fertility, expand their family, balance their families. It's a very lovely job.
That is lovely. in terms of just like fertility and infertility, I feel like a lot of women are very private or just hush-hush about it. I don't want to say it's taboo, but it's just like if somebody's going through IVF or whatever they're going through, I find that they're like more, they don't want to share it right away because there's, you know, everybody's always has all these superstitions about pregnancy. So what do you think that comes from? And how do you think that we can normalize fertility talk?
Yeah, I think it comes from a place where as women, we feel, or some of us feel that's our duty. This is what we're made for. This is what we're bred for, to create life. And when it's not happening easily, some people will internalize that as a personal failure. And it's hard to share our failures, right? It's really difficult when everyone around you is having gender reveals, baby showers, you know, 5, 10 kids, you know, 31, Kate plus, you know, 8. And then you're trying to have your first baby or expand your family. And it's difficult. And not everyone is understanding. Not everyone is tactful. And so sometimes it's difficult to share that. And then it also might be just a perception that we have. People sometimes can be more understanding than we give them credit. And you're just too afraid to share what you're going through because you fear that you're going to be judged.
Right. Definitely. And I like that because it's like very empathetic also for like what they're going through. So how do you think that we can normalize it? What do you think we need to do?
Yeah. So one way to normalize it is just for us all to be open about our struggles. I think that people feel that it's just so easy to get pregnant. And when you're getting those invitations to a baby shower, you may not know that your friend suffered from 2 miscarriages in her own fertility journey. And it's just that if we're open as women, if we're supportive as women, if we're able to talk to each other more and just share those happinesses and those sad times more frequently, then we'll know just that it's difficult for a lot of people and no one is alone in this. And just being very uplifting. I also think that, social media has played a great role in opening eyes to just let people know what is happening in some people's, you know, private lives, whether it be celebrities or just, you know, regular people. And also if you look at Hollywood and movies, you know, just discussing it in an open format like that. It's not just, you know, a one night stand, you get pregnant and you have this baby. Sometimes it's really, really difficult. And stories about those things just help people know it's not just me.
Yeah. So really it's about making women feel like, because you're saying women feel like they've failed because they feel like this is something they should biologically be able to do. So kind of just talking about it, less of it being a failure and like, this is life. And it's not so normal to just get pregnant, and just talking more about making sure women feel like they, and know that it's not a failure. They didn't do anything wrong. So at what point in our lives should we be considering our own fertility?
You know, that's a loaded question because a lot of us, you know, like it took me a long time to get through school just because that's, you know, the nature to be a doctor takes so long right. to do it. And it really depends on what your personal journey is in life. I don't think people should be forced to have babies sooner than they're ready to because of a biological clock. But I do think that we should be being proactive, you know. So for instance, people who are in the medical field, you know, if you're going to finish in your mid to early 30s, you know, thinking about egg freezing is something that may help you. Not everyone needs to do it, but at least you should know it's available. A lot of my friends in high school, they started families in their 20s. They were married and that was just what they did. I think that it's a really personal choice. But what I will say that once you hit 35, if you haven't really started thinking about it, you need to really, just like we planned everything else, you need to be planning what your reproductive future is. Are you going to do it as a single woman? Because I find a lot of patients now are being proactive in that regard of just saying, I'm going to do it on my own. Are you going to freeze your eggs? Are you guys going to have your next child? What are your plans? Because after 35, it becomes a little bit more difficult. Surely after 40, it becomes very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And after 42, the success rates, even with the greatest advances like IVF, are really poor. And so you really can kind of pigeonhole yourself into a space that's going to lead to a lot of heartache and a lot of money if you haven't at least started opening up that conversation with yourself and then with your spouse, with your partner, with your family, if that's what you want to do. But you have to start thinking about it at least by 35.
So 35, let's say you want to, If you're at 35 and you want to kind of delay getting pregnant, right? You want to freeze your eggs or freeze your embryos with your partner. That's when you said, that's like when you should start doing it. What about if you're younger and you know that you're not ready then? Would you recommend that someone do that early on? If they can afford it, of course.
Yeah, that's the key. You know, you don't want to put yourself in a bind financially, but when you hit 30 and you know you're on a different career path, you know you're on a different trajectory, and you just don't want kids anytime soon, the best time to freeze your eggs would probably be in your, you know, late 20s, early 30s. And some people know ahead of time that they just are going to wait. Some people don't. But I do think that if you're 30 and you know that, then you should try to freeze your eggs as soon as you can.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So what's the difference between, because you say freezing eggs, but you could also freeze embryos. What is that difference and what should people know about that?
Yeah, there's a really big difference. So freezing eggs are our own, right? So we have eggs and they're just mine. So if I freeze them and in 5 years I want to use them, that's my business. I don't have to ask anybody any more permission. Right. But if I freeze embryos with a partner, they're ours. And so that's a big difference, because if I'm trying to secure my fertility and in 5 years something happens to that relationship, we both have to turn the key to use it. And you can see that in some, you know, like stories like Sofia Vergara. You know, it was actually her that she's the one who didn't want to use the embryos. Her ex-husband wanted to use them. And they ruled that, you know, they couldn't be used. So if it was on the flip side and it was her and she was, you know, an older woman and probably didn't have the same opportunity to make new embryos with a new partner, that could be really devastating. For him, you know, men, their fertility go on for a lot longer than ours. So he still has the opportunity to create life with someone else. But as a woman, mm-hmm. I am very cautious about freezing embryos if you're not sure what's going to happen. You know, so like right. for my cancer patients, you know, this might be your only shot. And if they're eggs, they're yours. If they're yeah. embryos, you better get something in writing to say, these are mine because I might not have another chance later.
Right. Before I ask about the process of doing all of that, is there a difference in like the viability or like of an embryo versus freezing an egg? Like, do you have a greater chance of an embryo surviving because that science has been around longer? Correct me if I'm wrong about that, versus freezing eggs?
Yeah, so for sure, eggs are one cell. The embryos that we freeze typically are at what's called a blastocyst stage, and a blastocyst is about 112, 115 cells. So when you freeze them, if you freeze one cell, you got to hope that one cell thaws. And if you freeze and thaw a blastocyst, there is more likely that you're going to have a sufficient number survive that thaw. The survival rate for embryos is a lot better than eggs. But I will say most eggs will not make an embryo regardless if you would have made an embryo before freezing it or after thawing it. For instance, if I have a patient who's using donor eggs from a 20-year-old donor, if I get six eggs, we may get one embryo from that 20-year-old donor. Not every egg is ever going to make an embryo. So when you lose some in a thawing process, you know, some of it may be from the technique. A lot of it may be that the egg was not a great quality. And again, that egg may not have made an embryo to begin with. So if you freeze a significant number of eggs, you typically will get enough back to have success if the clinic that you're going to is reputable and knows what they're doing when they're freezing and thawing eggs. So I don't use it as a point of saying to a woman, oh, you should freeze eggs, embryos over eggs, because it's going to be much more successful. Because again, you may not be able to use them at all if your partner doesn't agree.
Right.
Eggs being thawed usually around 70 to 80% or 70 to 90% survival rate in most clinics. So most patients will be able to thaw them and utilize them, but neither eggs or embryos are absolute guarantees that there'll be a live birth.
Right. Could you talk through the like difference in the egg freezing process in terms of what the woman has to do versus like IVF versus embryo extraction, all of that, the different process? Because I feel like if you don't know, it just feels like it's all either all the same or too complicated to look up.
Yeah. So they all start off the same. So usually most of us use birth control pills in the beginning of a cycle, generally like 2 days after a menstrual cycle starts, to keep the little houses or follicles that hold eggs, to keep them at rest. Then you take injectable medications, usually 2 to 3 times a day, to stimulate those follicles that hold the eggs to grow. The larger follicles will allow an egg to mature. Smaller follicles, even though an egg can be retrieved from it, the egg inside may not mature. So we're trying to get those little follicles. They usually start off at really small, like 2 millimeters, and we're trying to get them to grow to 18 to 20 millimeters over about a 2-week time period. So it's a lot of injections, but for egg freezing, embryo, IVF, it all starts off the same. once. And then in that time frame, you're getting monitored with blood tests, mainly estrogen, because as those follicles grow, they produce estrogen. So your estrogen level is going to get higher. And that's how we know you're responding appropriately to the medication. And you also do ultrasounds, and they're usually transvaginal, so we can see the ovaries and measure the sizes of those follicles accurately. After about 2 weeks of injections, then you do a final shot that will trigger the final maturation of the eggs inside of the follicles. And to retrieve the eggs, you do an ultrasound, usually under some conscious sedation, and a needle is placed through the vagina into those follicles that have fluid in the egg inside, and it takes about 10-15 minutes to do, and that's it. So for egg freezing, you would be done at that point. The eggs would be frozen on that day, and you could go to work the next day. If you are doing embryos, then once those eggs are retrieved, instead of just freezing them, they're inseminated with the sperm, either the partner or donor sperm, and then they're grown out, depending on what you're trying to do, to a stage where they're going to either be frozen. If you're doing IVF to get pregnant, you can potentially have a fresh transfer. And if you're doing genetic testing, they would be biopsied to check if they're chromosomally normal, and gender could also be ascertained from a biopsy, and then frozen. But they all start off with birth control pills and injections and a retrieval of those eggs. And then it kind of branches off from that point on what the outcome is you're trying to achieve.
Right. You mentioned that you biopsy the embryos to check for, to do genetic testing. Could that affect anything? Because you're kind of...
Yeah, you know. So it is a micromanipulation. Most embryos do well, but the more you manipulate an embryo, it's not, you know, it definitely has a risk to it, albeit the risk small. For older women, the risk don't outweigh the benefit most of the time, because in older women, a lot of the embryos that are made will be aneuploid or have an abnormal number of chromosomes. And if they're transferred for pregnancy, they're unlikely to stick, they're more likely to miscarry, or potentially could lead to a child with complex abnormalities. And so doing a biopsy, though there is some risk to it, will, you know, not be as harmful as the potential sequelae.
Just going back to considering your own fertility, is there, so say you want to try to get pregnant, are there any conditions that, you know, you, if you know that you're aware of that you have, that might, that you should know that might affect future fertility and, you know, get your ability to get pregnant?
Polycystic ovary syndrome, or PCOS, is very common and definitely will cause some women to not ovulate. And if that's your phenotype and you're not ovulating, you're not going to have the opportunity to conceive because you're not releasing an egg. And those women, it doesn't make any sense for someone to say, try for a year, try for 6 months, because if you're not releasing an egg, there's no chance. So those people should get evaluations quicker and potentially medication to help them ovulate, or different remedies to address what's going on that may help them ovulate on their own. Like, I have patients who do some weight loss, and then they start having regular cycles. And so then for them, you know, trying without an evaluation after having regular cycles may be okay. If you've had a diagnosis of gonorrhea and chlamydia, those, even if it was treated very quickly, it was a long time ago, I would suggest getting a tubal evaluation, because gonorrhea and chlamydia can definitely make tubal factor infertility a cause for concern in a patient. The tubes are how the egg gets into the uterus. And so if your tube, one or both of them, are not functioning, then that can, you know, destroy your fertility, or at least impact it in a way where it's going to take you potentially longer to conceive. Endometriosis is also something that can affect tubes. The level of inflammation that someone has can also impact pregnancy, independent on tubal factor. And so if you have a diagnosis of endometriosis, you should probably seek help sooner. Males kind of fly under the radar, but they contribute to 40 to 50% of infertility. And so I would say if your partner has ever used like testosterone, that's something that is like a male birth control that no one ever tells them. I don't know why. They just use it. And it's like, I didn't know it was going to affect my sperm, but it absolutely can make your sperm go to zero. Wow. And so those kind of things you would just want to, and I interact with those kind of patients all the time. It's like no one ever tells them. There's a lot of physicians and independent sites that prescribe testosterone for males. And, you know, if it's something that your partner has used, you just would probably want to get a semen analysis to make sure there's no impact there that needs to be addressed. Those are the main things.
Yeah. I thank you for bringing up male fertility. How do you determine whether or not who is the cause for the delay, the infertility? How do you figure that out?
Yeah. And so, and we have to be very, I'm very careful, just like you were very careful in choosing your words, because it's no one's fault, right? And we're just trying to find out what the underlying issues are. And so both partners will need to do a workup. For a woman, the typical workup is ovarian reserve testing, which includes hormonal testing to see the functioning of the follicles that she has in a month's time. Typically, anti-Mullerian hormone is one of them. Follicle stimulating hormone and estrogen are another. They're done in a specific time in the cycle. But AMH is something like, if you have ever seen like modern fertility ads, you can just, you know, order outside of a doctor and they can give you the results. But it's a very helpful test to show you where you are at a certain age with how many eggs, or what your egg supply potentially is at that age. An ultrasound is also done. We can look at the uterus. A lot of women will have fibroids or ovarian cyst, potentially a dilated tube if there's a history of infection. So you can get a lot of information just from an ultrasound. And ultrasounds are not done at your general doctor's visits. Women will get an ultrasound if they have an active issue that needs to be addressed. Women will get an ultrasound when they're pregnant. But outside of that, when a patient asks me, why do I have these fibroids and no one's ever told me, didn't they get it on my pap smear? It's like, no, you can't find that on a pap smear. And they didn't have an indication to do an ultrasound. So I find a lot of pathology just on an initial visit, because it's never probably been done in her lifetime. So the blood testing, the ultrasound, and HSG to test the tubes we talked about, that's a typical test that we do, since that's a very important part of natural fertility. And then a semen analysis. I feel like the men get off very easily.
Seriously.
Yeah. But it's gives us a lot of information about the potential that he has for natural fertility. And then if there's a problem with the sperm, it also gives us a lot of information on what potentially could be done, or what the underlying issue could be.
So if you don't already know that you have these pre-existing conditions and to like actually seek the fertility help before, how long should you be trying before you're just like, okay, I give up, like something's not right?
So if you're less than 35, typically it could take up to a year to conceive naturally if you don't have anything going on that you know of. And if you're over 35, we recommend only waiting for 6 months. And it's more because the window of opportunity to intervene is smaller, right? And
right.
So you don't want, you know, someone who is, you know, 38 to use a whole year and now they're 39 when mm-hmm. their better chances would have been at 38. if you're 40, I probably wouldn't even wait 6 months. I think that, you know, that window is so narrow that, you know, just to get an evaluation, I'm a big proponent of an evaluation, even if you don't need any treatment. Not everyone right. who gets an evaluation needs to go to IVF or needs to take a medication. They just sometimes need a peace of mind to make sure that everything is okay and you're at a good place to start trying and to be successful, right? But right. if you try for a year and you don't have open tubes, that's a year wasted.
Well, will doctors just not see, like, let's say you're 30 years old and you're now at the 4 month mark and you're like, I'm not getting pregnant. I'm concerned. Will a doctor say, no, you need to wait another 2 months, or they'll say, okay, let's just come in, like you were saying, for an evaluation. We could check it out. Or it depends on the doctor.
I've had 25 year olds come to me, and I really, the biggest thing I can do, cause I do feel like you can be pulled into this psychological, like, thing of I need treatment, I have to do this, and I don't want to fear monger any person. I want to empower right. them, right? And so if you have been trying for 3 months and it hasn't worked and everybody around you is pregnant, let's do a little ultrasound and make sure. Maybe an AMH, you know, if you want to check your tubes, but I am very cautious in going straight to treatment because it's like, you know, you're going to also be investing money. So if we do an evaluation and everything is fine and you've only been trying for a couple of months, it might give you peace of mind. But if you're like, no, I really want to get this show on the road, you know, that's someone's prerogative too. It's not really my position to judge, but I don't want to make someone fearful and think that they have to have these treatments because sometimes they're very expensive and sometimes you'll get pregnant in between a treatment cycle on your own, you know, and, yeah. and that's, I count that baby too.
So say you do kind of like you go in for a consult, you find out what one or both of the partners are having trouble conceiving. What are the options that they can do to get pregnant, have a baby?
The options are typically based on what the underlying conditions are. So if it's a male factor and it's only mild, maybe there's a little bit of a motility issue, then an intrauterine insemination can be helpful. Because if you think about how we conceive naturally, the sperm is deposited in the vagina and it has to swim up the cervix. The cervix is like an underwater cave with all these like nooks and crannies. There's cervical mucus. So most of the sperm that are deposited in the vagina don't get into the uterus. And so what an intrauterine insemination will do, especially if there's a motility issue, it will bypass the cervix and give the sperm a little bit of a head start to get to the eggs, which are typically waiting in the fallopian tubes for fertilization. So that procedure is not as invasive as most. It does require some timing. And sometimes it's done with medication, even if the woman is ovulatory. In same-sex couples, IUIs are necessary most of the time because there's no male partner. And sometimes they'll try it at home and it doesn't work with intracervical inseminations. And then, you know, the same thing, it can definitely help get more sperm to that area. If a woman doesn't ovulate, like a polycystic ovary patient, or if she's been trying a year, she's ovulating, we'll super ovulate her to have more eggs be released. And there's more targets for sperm in that way. So for ovulation induction, there's a couple meds that we use. Clomid is something probably your listeners have heard about most frequently. Clomid acts on your estrogen receptors, and so it makes your body feel like your estrogen is low. And when your body feels like something is not balanced and it wants to go towards balance, and so it increases the hormones that help estrogen be produced, and a byproduct of that is having more eggs released. And so that can be very helpful to some couples, especially those who are struggling with anovulation. Letrozole is another medication that works in a similar way to Clomid, where it helps you to release more eggs or release an egg if you're not ovulatory. It's preferred in polycystic ovary patients. And then the gonadotropins or the injectable medications will just stimulate your ovaries directly to produce more eggs. Those are the same hormones that we use in an IVF cycle. So they're very strong, and unfortunately, they're very expensive. So for Clomid and Letrozole, we're talking about like $5, $10, you know, with a coupon at Costco. But gonadotropins can be a dollar a unit, and it's usually like 100 units a day. So that adds up very quickly. It's a very, very expensive medications to use, and a lot of times insurances don't cover it. So, you know, it's... we're very judicious when we use that. Then there's IVF. So IVF is, we have kind of gone over it before, but I had a mentor who would say, like, if Clomid is walking and gonadotropins are taking a motorcycle, then IVF is like taking a rocket ship to get you to where you're going. It can be very effective, and especially in a good age group. But it's also very expensive and very timely and very invasive. But it usually is about a month process if you're doing a fresh transfer, and about a 3 month process if you're doing a frozen embryo transfer.
So what would be the, you say fresh transfer or frozen transfer? Is there ever an instance where you do want to get pregnant right away, but they're going to freeze the embryos for, or eggs or embryos or whatever, before they transfer them?
Yes. The main reason we do frozen embryo transfers is in some patients you can overstimulate. So typically our bodies release one egg at a time, one egg a month. For IVF, we're trying to get as many as we can. So you may get 15, 20, 30. Some people who have less ovarian reserve, they may get less eggs than that. But the more eggs you get, the more your body is at risk for a syndrome called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. And the pregnancy hormone, beta-HCG, will perpetuate that syndrome. It will keep your hormone levels high and then start to release other hormones that can cause you to get very ill. And so doing a frozen embryo transfer helps to prevent that beta-HCG from being made and then your body further being stimulated, and it can prevent you from getting sick. So a lot of my polycystic ovary syndrome patients who get a lot of eggs in an IVF cycle, a frozen embryo transfer would be better because it would be less risky. There is some data to suggest that frozen embryo transfers may have a slight advantage over fresh, because in a frozen cycle, your hormone levels are a little closer to physiologic. If you think about releasing 20 eggs, your estrogen level is going to be 3,000-4,000. In a natural cycle, your estrogen level is 200-300. And so mimicking more of a natural cycle may have a benefit in some patients for success. So those are the main reasons we choose a frozen over fresh, but fresh embryo transfers can work in some patients as long as it's done safely.
You mentioned like IUI earlier. What's the difference between IUI and IVF?
So IUI, everything is still going to be in the body. So the egg is going to be released. It's going to be in the fallopian tube. I can't see any of it. And I think for fertility specialists, we like control. And so for IVF, I can see the embryo. I know what it looks like. I know the grade of it. I can even know the genetics of it. And so then it just has to stick. Whereas IUI, it's more natural. Everything's in the body. And we know the body can function. Pregnancies can happen. But when it doesn't work, I don't really know where it went awry. I just know that the egg was released at this time. The sperm was placed in this time. Did they meet? I don't know. I can't see it. Did a normal embryo get created? I don't know. I can't see it. Does it implant? I don't know. I only know hindsight if it works, because if you have a positive pregnancy test, all of that stuff would have had to happen. you know, for it to have worked. But if it, you don't get a positive pregnancy test with an IUI, don't know where in the system it failed.
And you also mentioned same-sex partners. I think that's also important to talk about. What are options for same-sex partners? How do they conceive?
Yeah, so for same-sex females, I always start with, you know, what do you guys envision this family to be? Because we have two women who both may have ovaries, who both may have eggs, who both may have a uterus. So who wants to carry? Who wants to use whose eggs? You know, that's kind of important because when you're in a heterosexual couple, there's not those options. You know, there's only one uterus and there's one sperm sample. Then it's, you know, trying to match them with a donor that they are either, if both women want to be biological parents, then we want to choose a donor that's fit for both of them. And donors are screened for genetic conditions. Donors are screened for different infections that can be different for the two different partners. So we want to try to match them so they can potentially use the same donor if that's important for that family. But mainly for two women, as long as I have eggs and a uterus, they can do an intrauterine insemination. They can do IVF and they can do reciprocal IVF, which is where one woman uses her eggs, they use the donor sperm to create embryos, and then that embryo is transferred into her partner's uterus for her to carry. So then they both can feel like they're contributing to the pregnancy. And then some women, they never want to be pregnant. So it's like, I don't want to use my uterus, but I might want to use my eggs, or, you know, something has happened. One may not be able to use her uterus. So reciprocal IVF can be very helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Science is amazing. Listening to the conversation is just like, it is amazing.
It's like what you could do.
There are so many options for so many people, like despite the fact that, what is the statistic for like the rate of infertility?
It's about 1 in 8 couples will experience a form of infertility. So that's a lot.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, and we should be talking about it more.
Yeah. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you feel like that our listeners should know about when it comes to this topic?
Yeah, so there's one thing that we didn't discuss is a newer technology that's super cool called Invacell. Invacell, for me, is kind of groundbreaking. It's taking a step back from IVF. It's in between an IUI and IVF. And why I like it is because, you know, financially, not everyone is in a position to do IVF. So typically, I think the national average for IVF is potentially about like $15,000, which is a lot of money. Invacell will probably put that around $8,000 to $10,000, which is still, you know, that's nice little Chanel bag.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about barriers and access to care, you know, finances is a big thing because not everyone is in a state that's mandated for coverage. And if you have to come out of this out of pocket, you know, before a baby's even born, you're in the hole and you just feel, you know, and it doesn't work every time the first time. And so it can really add up. But Invacell, the way it works is a big expense of IVF is actually growing the embryos in the lab. And so instead of growing the embryos in a lab, they're grown in a device, and that device is placed into the woman's vagina. And so she becomes her own incubator. I love how y'all perked up. Isn't that cool, though?
That's crazy.
That is insane.
So a robot is inserted.
And it cuts the cost tremendously. And for some women, especially like same-sex couples, that can be also helpful because the partner can then carry and, you know, and carry just for 5 days, and you're incubating your own embryos. And wow, just opening up that to people, the success rates are a little less than IVF, and they're significantly more than IUI. but that opportunity being afforded to more people will just help more families. So I'm very excited about it. I'm very happy that people are thinking outside of the box to help get this kind of care that so many people will need, making it at an affordable price. And I hope the medications become more affordable too, if anyone out there is listening, because I think it's a little ridiculous.
Yeah. Can you spell it? You said it's Envocell.
So it's Envocell.
Envocell. At first I thought you said imbecile. I was like, let's spell it.
That's really cool.
That is cool. Speaking of science, like it's also amazing. And like, it feels good to know that like things are being worked on still, like actively. This isn't just like, okay, these are your options. Sorry, you know, but that's amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. I had no idea. And I'm sure a lot of people haven't. Is it still in trials, or is this something that people are doing?
It's out and about. Clinics will carry it. Not every clinic is doing it, but I hope it becomes a lot more mainstream, but it is FDA approved. And yeah, no, it's not beta phase anymore. It's awesome. Out there.
That's amazing.
I can't wait to hear more about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jones. This has been awesome. Thank you for imparting all of your knowledge and wisdoms. And I hope that everybody listening learned something new, because I definitely did. And so how can people follow you, or maybe if they're in Dallas, come to your clinic?
Yeah. So we are at Conceive Fertility Center. So it's www.conceivefertilitycenter.com. And you can reach out to me via social media. I'm at TJonesIVFMD. On Instagram, and I'm also on Facebook, but not that much.
Who is? Well, thank you so much, for real. Really appreciate it. And that is it for this episode of Betches Moms podcast. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow Betches Moms on Instagram. Follow Dr. Jones everywhere. You can follow her, not on Facebook, and follow us. I'm at Aileen. Brittany is at Britt Rich. And remember, there are no rules on this podcast. I'm not like a regular mom.
I'm a cool mom, right, Regina?
Yeah, sure are.
Please stop talking.
The Betches Moms podcast is produced by Sean Kilby and Jorge Morales Pico. Editing by Stacey Wong. Social media by Brittany Levine. Guest booking by Nicole Pellegrino. Be sure to follow us at Betches Moms on Instagram and send us your emails to moms@betches.com. Betches.